WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, welcome to Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi, and this is kind of the Thanksgiving edition of Monday Night Talk. I will be your head turkey, as we have a great show lined up for you. Chuckle you just heard is from State Representative Jim Cantwell, who will be joining me around 6:30-ish.
That's fine.
He was scheduled to join us at 6:20. I get a late call today, but having the governor on.
I think I would defer to the governor to take 10 minutes or 20, whatever the amount of time.
Well, I did mention the fact that I did have house royalty here. and seeing that you were going to be here talking a little about your trip to Bonn, Germany.
Yes, yes.
That's going to be a good conversation. And also, I'll be able to tip my hat. I believe there's some festivities in your father's honor.
Yes.
You want to kind of shed light on that when your segment's up?
Of course, we'll do.
We're going to speak with the governor for a couple of moments after traffic, but some new legislation called the CARE Act. This is a continued effort to fight the opioid and heroin epidemic. Also, I believe that the governor signed some bipartisan legislation today.
That he has.
What was it?
Criminal justice.
No.
Well, the criminal justice came out from us, but the bipartisan one, there were two.
Contraceptive.
Two. One is extending, making sure contraceptive coverage, despite what might be happening at the federal level, that we would assure that people in MassHealth will have the coverage.
And he signed that bill today.
That he did.
So he talks about that a little bit with us. He will. Also, Kevin Higgins. Do you know who Kevin Higgins is?
I do not.
Kevin is running for state representative in the 7th Plymouth District. So he'll be following you.
Right.
He'll come in for a few minutes, talk a little bit about his campaign for office.
He didn't want to run in the 4th Plymouth, but what he...
You're kind of a titan in the 4th.
He could move.
And he's a Democrat. Why would he want, to take on...
I don't know. We're open to all. We're all good people.
So he'll be in. And then, are you Olympic? Are you an Olympic kind of a guy?
You can't tell from my physique that,
What would your sport be?
I guess I'd have to be swimming because I'm not like a wrestler. And if you saw me ski, you'd make sure people would stay out of the way.
Okay. Well, Chris Freeman is a cross-country skier.
Really?
He's an Olympian.
Nice.
Four-time Olympian.
Wow.
And we're going to talk a little bit about, do you know that November is Diabetes Awareness Month?
I did know that.
We are going to talk with him about some groundbreaking technology that is being that is helping to modernize treatment for diabetes.
Fantastic.
So we'll talk with him about that. And do you know who Archer Mayer is?
No, you're stumping me now.
I know. It's okay. I didn't give you enough information.
It was a rhetorical question to it.
to prep for the test, the quiz. Archer is a best-selling, award-winning New England author. And this guy is almost like a real-life Renaissance man, as he has other jobs. He's a detective. He's a death investigator.
Wow.
And he actually has just released his 28th installment of the popular Joe Gunther detective series.
Very cool.
Yes, and that latest installment is called Trace. So we'll talk with him about that. And then we're going to hear from the folks from the Jubilate Chorale. This is a choral group.
Right.
And we'll speak with President Jay Enos, Dr. Maxine Aslan, who is the music director and conductor, and Paul Watson, talk about their upcoming concert on December 10th.
You have a lot going on tonight. Very good.
Again, we do our best to try to make it an informative show. I mean, we could always just sit here and talk about one item or one issue for the entire night. We could do that. But so far, this has been successful in being able to talk about multiple subjects. Right. So that's what we do here. So
November, Thanksgiving. I like pumpkin pie.
I like apple pie.
Butternut squash.
Mashed potato.
Sweet potato.
Green bean casserole.
Ooh, rice pilaf. Homemade stuffing. Cranberry sauce. Hot butter rolls.
Turkey, duh.
Giblet gravy.
Ugh.
This has nothing to do with Brennan's Smoke Shop, but everything to do with food. Happy Thanksgiving from our family to yours. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, making traditional Thanksgiving dinner complete since 1993. Visit us on the web at brennansmokeshopma.com. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Actually, it's good. I'm just going to leave that one there. That was good.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Hey, welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And our first guest joining us, we are welcoming back the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Governor, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
How you doing, Kevin?
We're doing pretty good. Before we get started, I want to wish you all a belated happy birthday. I know you were celebrating your birthday last week.
You know, I'm to the point now where I'm happy to have them, but I try not to keep too close an attention to the number.
Absolutely. I definitely understand. Reason why we have you on, a couple of things.
Thank you.
Absolutely. How did you celebrate? Did you celebrate in some quiet way?
Yeah, my wife and I went out to dinner at a restaurant in the neighborhood.
Good thing to do. Definitely a good
Very
thing
Very low-key.
Well, I know since your administration took office, one of the keen focuses that you guys have looked to tackle is the opioid and heroin epidemic. I know within the last week, the administration released news of a package that also includes legislation called the CARE Act. Now, with the limited time that we have for the segment, could you briefly kind of share some details of the initiative?
Sure, Kevin. What I would start by saying is that, we passed a bill a couple years ago, and there were four key pillars to it: prevention, education, intervention, treatment, and recovery. And this legislation and some of the administrative actions we're going to take going forward build on that. And let's start with the fact that we get the fact that this remains a terrible crisis here in the Commonwealth, but there is some good news. The prevention education initiatives that we pursued previously seem to have bent the trend a little bit. Instead of having a continued climb in opioid prescription writing, overdoses, and deaths, which has been happening every year for the past 15 years in Massachusetts, we actually saw a 30% decline in prescriptions and a 10% drop in deaths for the first 9 months of 17 over the first 9 months of 16. That's the first time that's happened in 15 years. That's the good news. We can also take a certain measure of satisfaction in the fact that literally 97% of the prescriptions that are being written in Massachusetts are being written using the prescription monitoring program we put in place about a year ago. So there's some good news there. We've also added 1,100 treatment beds over the course of the past couple of years, which is another good piece of news. But obviously, there's still far too many people who are dying, far too many people who are dealing with addiction generally. And the other really bad news in this is the presence of fentanyl. If you go back to 2014, fentanyl was present about 15% of the time in the overdose deaths in Massachusetts. In 2017, it's present in about 80% of them. So the arrival of this synthetic fentanyl, which is manufactured in China, and literally in some cases gets mailed into the U.S., in other cases finds its way into the U.S. through Mexico, has really become a very significant and very deadly part of the whole opioid heroin problem in Massachusetts. The new bill basically does a couple of things, which I'll speak to briefly. One is we don't have a very good aftercare system for people after they receive detox services. And part of the reason for that is because we haven't really done a very good job of describing it, credentialing it, certifying it, and then figuring out how to pay for it the way we would with the way we treat people who are dealing with diabetes or congestive heart failure or some other chronic condition. So we need to do that. And this bill would authorize the Commonwealth to put together a lot of the standards and the rules around aftercare and credentialing and all the rest. The second big thing it does is it takes a really hard run at what I would call the whole notion of reporting and making docs and other prescribers who are prescribing way beyond the limits that are established under state law, automatically having them referred to their boards of registration, so those boards can actually engage their practitioner community and how to become much more consistent with the rules with respect to prescribing. Because prescribing's down, we still prescribe too much. We need more treatment capacity. We're continuing to build that. But the big thing we really need to do is create an aftercare system for people who come out of detox and that are looking to be supported in the community as they go back to their whatever their daily life is.
What kind of investment is the state going to have to invest into this legislation, and how has the Trump administration been receptive to combating the epidemic?
So we think the total value of the investment we're proposing to make here is somewhere between $140 and $150 million of state and federal money. And obviously, the federal money is going to be coming from Washington, and we are going to see if we can get the Trump administration to help us with a couple of relatively minor waivers here to make it possible for pharmacists to be more involved in dispensing Narcan, which is an overdose reversal drug. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to see if we can get the feds to help us a little bit with some of the rules around addiction treatment for people who are dealing with addiction. I served, as you know, I think, on the President's Opioid Task Force. We produced a pretty good report. It's got a lot of things in there they can do administratively and a bunch of things they can do with regulation and with statutory change. And my hope is that they chase some of that stuff because it will make a big difference.
Well, we thank you for at least discussing that legislation and the package, the CARE Act, and we'll look forward to more news on that. Probably the other thing, if you could touch upon briefly before we let you go, again, we're speaking with Governor Charlie Baker, is you signed a bipartisan contraceptive coverage legislation today. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that was the access bill, which has been, which passed the Senate, I think, unanimously, and passed the House, I think, like 135 to 15 or something like that. Pretty bipartisan. Worked through with the health insurance plans and with the provider community, and generally we'll make sure that, you know, sort of irrespective of whatever federal policy we have in Washington, women in Massachusetts will have access to very affordable reproductive services and birth control and family planning services. And, you know, there's a growing body of evidence out there that if we do the right kinds of things with this, if we give women access to the services that they need to help them ensure that they make good decisions on this stuff and they have access to the right kinds of supports, you know, we've seen pretty significant drops in unwanted pregnancy and teen pregnancy, and those are good things.
Those are key things. Two last things I want to kind of throw at you, and that is, I know that you are a musically inclined kind of a guy, and we lost a couple of big names over the past couple of months, most recently Malcolm Young of AC/DC, kind of known as the glue guy of the group, suffering from dementia. He passed away the past 24 to 48 hours. And then Tom Petty, give me your thoughts on that.
You know, Malcolm Young was Angus Young's older brother.
Right.
Malcolm wrote most of the songs, although Angus was definitely the front man. There's no question about that. I saw them for the first time at Boston Garden when I was probably about 20, which at this point was a very long time ago. And I was a huge fan for a very long time. I think I think they're truly one of the greatest rock bands of all time. I think Back in Black, which is the album they made after their first lead singer, Bon Scott,
passed away,
died of alcohol poisoning. I think that was truly one of the greatest rock albums of all time. I think it's the second best-selling rock album of all time behind Thriller. And my mother died of Alzheimer's. I feel terrible for anybody who has to put up with and suffer through one of these terrible memory diseases. And I'm sure for Malcolm and his family and for Angus and for the rest of their family, this whole thing was a really horrible, crummy way for it all to come to an end for him. But boy, what a band and what a legacy.
Yep.
And as far as Tom Petty's concerned, you know, another sort of major force in music throughout my lifetime. And I know he wasn't from Boston. He's from Florida, but a lot of his early material kind of broke on Boston radio. And he had a huge fan base here long before he had a fan base in many other places. And I saw him play here a few times. I saw him play at the Paradise like 12 zillion years ago.
Great club.
And then most recently, like a lot of people, I saw him play at Fenway in 2014.
Year, yeah.
And they just blew the roof off that place, to the extent that Fenway has a roof. but what I would say is that Tom Petty, like Malcolm Young and the guys in AC/DC, they just really knew how to write a hook. I mean, the amount of material that those two bands, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and AC/DC, put out just year after year after year, you just couldn't wait to fire up first on your turntable and then in your cassette player and then on your CD and then eventually on your iPod and then on your phone was mind-boggling.
Yep.
I mean, what a repertoire and what a library for both of them. But they do say one very important thing to both you and me, Kevin, which is we are not as young as we used to be, and there's just no question about that.
Amen. Amen. Well, listen, our time here is done. I want to wish you and yours a happy Thanksgiving. I hope you have a great holiday, and we look forward to the next time that we talk to you, my friend.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Kevin. You take care, and you have a great holiday, too.
You got it. There he is.
Bye-bye.
Charlie Baker joining us here on Monday Night Talk, and we're going to step aside when we come back. State Representative Jim Cantwell will be joining us right here on 95.9 WATD. You're listening to Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
And we return to Monday Night Talk, and joining us is none other than State Representative Jim Cantwell. Now, I will say, just a little bit of a disclaimer. The representative was booked in advance for a 20-minute segment, but was kind enough to say...
I would defer to the chief executive, and you're kind enough to have me in at different times, so I'm happy to come back whenever you need us.
And you do a great job. And
thanks.
You've not only filled role as a guest, but you've been a co-host from time to time.
That's all. And as you bring people in, I'm happy to come and be able to...
I'm disappointed, though. You didn't invite me to your trip to Bonn, Germany.
Well, you were in Paris. We were reaching out to you. You were at Disney World, European Disneyland, so...
No.
Disneyland Paris. Get it right. They changed it. Celebrating 25 years. What was it? What was the trip like? Now, from what I understand, it was yourself.
Yes.
And another partner of the law firm, Josh Cutler.
Yes. Yep. And Tom Colliter had to stay here at home to make sure things would still proceed appropriately. So the two of the three C's went.
Now, this was a special occasion, a climate talks.
Yes, it was.
For the UN?
For the United Nations. One of the things, it's one of the greatest honors of my life in representing Marshfield and Scituate. We've been doing so much work, as you know, Kevin, covering all things that relate to coastal adaptation. As we say often, we have a triple threat. We're having rising sea levels, we're having more frequent storms, and we have old, crumbling infrastructure. So I've been working the last 9 years to try to address infrastructure, to get funding for seawalls, fighting to get hopefully demonstration projects for wave attenuation devices, trying to fix some of our different dunes, looking to raise homes, looking at ways to do sand mining, all these things to try to protect from some of the negative implications of these storms. And that caught the eye of people from a Climate Action Business Association who go to these talks. They were there 2 years ago for the Paris Accord. They decided this year that Donald Trump wasn't sending many emissaries. They weren't people representing the federal government until later that week when they were pushing for clean coal, which is another story. But to have people that would come and represent the United States, Josh Cutler, myself, Jen Benson, and Mike Barrett were called upon to represent Massachusetts at these climate talks.
You mentioned the Paris Accords. I believe that since under this administration, the Trump administration, we pulled out of it, didn't we?
He has indicated that we'd like to have the federal government pull out. Still not possible until after the next presidential election. So the folks who were career diplomats who were there, we got to watch them as they were negotiating some of the terms of how each of the countries would be meeting the goals. We, by the way, in Massachusetts, one of the greatest issues for us is to go around and for people to come up and say, oh, you're from Massachusetts. We understand that you have just recently voted, which we did, to follow the regulations or the requirements, that is, of the Paris Accord. Governor Baker was out in front on it, bipartisan support for it. What we have already been doing under REGGIE, it's one of the acts that was passed years ago to regulate and enforcement for greenhouse gases, we intend to reduce our greenhouse gases by 80% by the year 2050, and indeed we hope to move even faster than that. That's important because when people look in our district saying, why are we getting 6 100-year storms just in the last decade, there are changes. People are seeing water reaching areas that we hadn't seen before.
Sure. Planet's warming up.
It is, which is affecting our fishing industry.
Polar caps melting.
All these issues, and we need to protect ourselves here. So one of the things are being there, the message overall was to say we're still in. That Massachusetts, and by the way, California, the only two states that had state legislators were Massachusetts and California, but to indicate that we're still in, we're going to follow those requirements as some other states will. What was very impressive to me is there was a panel there of business leaders. There was a vice president from Microsoft, another one from the Mars chocolate company, another from Target and Walmart, and they said, listen, it doesn't matter what happens by the federal government. We are still going to meet our objectives to reduce greenhouse gases, have new ways of having energy because it's good for the bottom line. They made the case of why business would prosper. One of the largest growing aspects of our Massachusetts economy is renewable energies. And they're saying some 50,000 new jobs that could be created in the next decade because of our switching to try to make sure we'll do more energy efficient lighting, more energy efficient solar systems on homes and such. So it was a very, very encouraging time to be there. I will tell you, Kevin, over and over again, talking to people from other countries, we have to remind ourselves that we hit the cosmic lottery to be born, to live here in this neck of the world, at this time in the world's history, with all the things that are going on. And I was reminded of it time and again, a panel that I was on, we were with the ambassador to Fiji, who talked about if we don't make improvements over the next few decades, his country is going to disappear by the end of the century.
That's right.
With the water will overtake them. I talked about what we saw a few years ago when we had, I call it, we're the canary in the coal mine, our area here for climate change and for these heavy storms. We had a seawall collapse, water rushed in, hit the panels of two homes. We had two homes burned to the ground in Scituate, over 100 got damaged. We talked about the need to invest in infrastructure, which is something I focus on. But then I turn and I hear from a gentleman from Malawi who says, you know what, we don't have energy. We don't have power for like 80% of the country. We, you know, for them, climate change, they're not talking energy. They're talking of food because it's changing the food distribution abilities and the ability to grow food to take care of their populations. If we don't act, you know, the concern is from our own State Department and from our Defense Department that if we're not going to take action on climate reductions and ways to address climate growth and climate change, that is, that we'll have millions of people moving around, similar to what happened in Syria, when just from that civil war, you know, over a million people left that country, and look at how it's destabilized Europe. So there are many, many reasons why we need to act. I lead with talking of we see the impacts of climate change in this district. Number two, the economic opportunities. Those jobs for putting solar arrays on our homes or changing lights, those are jobs that won't be exported. They stay right here in Massachusetts. Mm. We are competing with the Chinese. I sat in one program. Chinese essentially are stealing our technology, and they're doing a better job of kind of promoting it around the world. We want to regain our leadership role in these types of discussions for these new technologies, and then to regain our status around the world for these countries that were wondering, where is the United States? Where is our leadership? And for them to hear from state legislators in Massachusetts saying, we're still in, we're still going to follow the Paris Accord, I think made a great impression.
What would you say was, other than the concerns of rising seas and some of the things that are going to happen because of our climate changing, what were some of the other concerns you were hearing from folks from other countries?
From other countries, there were multiples. You know, partly you had countries that were saying that we had someone who was retelling a story from India saying that if there are changes in Bangladesh and people are trying to come across the border, they're already pretty tight borders, and they said, you know, that's going to create skirmishes, if not wars. Mm. For much of Africa, areas that already are suffering in abilities for food production, as that changes, that's going to make it very difficult for people. So people will be moving all around the continent, sure. And that could lead to further strife.
It's funny you mention India, because I was watching a report the other day in regards to, I guess in India they burn their fields, and it's a method, but when they burn their fields, it's so bad that people have to wear
masks.
They have to wear masks, right. And it's so bad that it's actually escalating the CO2 gases.
Yes.
And the gas house issues that, sure, we're seeing,
right,
and people saying it's something that has to stop.
But I agree. We'll try, you know, we'll do a link, by the way, to look a panel that Josh Cutler was on. Josh was speaking. There was a United States senator on his panel. There was the mayor for Pittsburgh on his panel. There was another
mayor.
Yeah, it was, you know, and I think we have the clip of that we can link here. My panel, they didn't video. Mine was with an ambassador to Fiji, was with someone from Malawi, was from a minister from Quebec, talking about how one energy that they're supplying here to us that is more green. Some people don't like hydro energy, but we want hydrokinetic. Anyone who lives along the coast can see the force of waves. We want to capture that kind of power to create energy. Fascinating times, really, to learn what's happening around the world and to learn how people look to us still and want to see America asserting leadership in this important area and others. And I was glad that to have the opportunity to represent.
So what comes of this? Do you have to do a report on this? Is this something that you report back to the House?
What we have, there are several pieces of legislation that we will be looking at. That part of it is that we come in and talk about, this is what we've learned. This is why the vote we took to remain and to follow the Paris Accord from 2015. That was a purpose. The other is to talk about, we have everything from a climate adaptation management plan that we're looking at as legislation. There are other things. Josh Cutler, myself, Jen Benson, and Mike Barrett are all on our Telecommunications and Energy Committee. So there'll be legislation there that we'll be able to report back on. But it just was a great opportunity and great honor.
Let's quickly, I want to give you a moment before our next guest joins us, Kevin Higgins, who is running for state representative in the 7th Plymouth District, is here. He'll join us in just a couple moments, but I want to give you a chance to, one of the things on your Facebook page, you were lauding the work of your colleagues in the House putting together the criminal justice reform bill, and at least pushing that forward. I think it was a 144-9 vote or correct. Something like that. Right. Talk to me about that, if you will. Give me your
sure.
thoughts.
First of all, led by a Plymouth County native, Claire Cronin was the chair for judiciary. We had over
Rockton one. Easton.
Yes, and I'm the vice chair with her. She's the leader.
11th Plymouth District.
That is hers, yes. We had over 100 hours of hearings, had experts who were the DAs came, sheriffs, defense counsel, community leaders across the board, folks talking of how we could try to be smart on crime, just ways that we could reduce recidivism, manners that we can address, everything from the first contact someone has with the court system all the way through when they leave and reenter society. So it's a comprehensive bill that I'll be happy to come back and talk in great length about. But areas that I was proud of, we just heard the governor speaking, and we're talking about things that we're doing, trying to prevent the use of drugs and with intervention, treatment, recovery. One of the issues we have these now, as a result of this bill, we'll have the strongest penalties for people who will be transporting and trying to sell carfentanil, which is just an outright poison. It's just,
right.
it's death. If so people
it's pretty
are,
bad.
So the minimum of folks, if they knowingly are selling or creating carfentanil, it'll be anywhere from three.
Popular guy, Jim.
Yeah, it'll be anywhere from 3.5 to 20 years in jail for that. Stronger penalties for fentanyl, for those types of things. But really, much of the bill is looking at ways to try to help people once you're in the system. Juveniles. Now, I was an assistant DA for 4 years. One reality we know, I'm not sure your age, but we know people are still developing up until age 25. You know, up until age 25, we're going to do some silly things. You know? So as long as it's not a crime that is a violent offense, a rape or a murder, we allow for people to have an expungement of their record so that won't follow them for the rest of their lives. Because as I point out, if Kevin and I got into a fight, which we never do, but if I kicked Kevin, that's a felony. That's assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. For young people getting into fisticuffs, a felony like that could follow them for 10 years.
It can, yep.
So we made ways to do bail reform, expungement. Corey reform is a way so that people, if they have committed a crime, they've been convicted, a felony stays there for 10 years. We're reducing that to 7, maybe even less. But studies are showing if someone for 3 years after having a conviction, if they stay out of the court system, stay out of trouble, after 3 years, pretty much people are finding their ways to not being doing criminal behavior. So we want to help folks who, if they have first-time accounts in that measure. We addressed for felony thresholds. It used to be a felony is if, right now, if someone went in and stole my phone's worth like $800, that would be a felony. Right now, anything over $250. So there are a lot of people who could be some routine crimes, again, yet could be young people. When people get to be my age, Kevin, people aren't necessarily doing crime anymore. We've gotten too old. It's too difficult to run away from the police. But it's for young people trying to make sure that for young folks, we're giving them an opportunity, a second chance in life. The things that I'm most proud of, though, one was for juveniles. And then secondly, solitary confinement. We had people come and testify to us about how much that does psychologically if you're in solitary confinement beyond an appropriate period of time. So we have a segregated review board that's going to have across the state have policies to make sure that some counties, like the sheriff you were talking about before, Bristol County may
have, Johnson, yeah.
yes, could have policies that were perhaps was doing solitary more than other more progressive sheriffs in Plymouth or Norfolk County. We're going to make sure that you can't, we preclude the use of segregation for juveniles and pregnant women, set limits on the length of time that an inmate could be held in segregation, and making sure there's a review board across the board that makes sure that's done in a responsible manner. So many more other issues. I'd love to come back on another time where we could talk about the bill in great
detail. Well, if you want, I can give you an extension to next week if you're not busy. At 6:20, we won't book anybody before you.
Okay, very good.
You can come back next week.
Good.
Again, that's State Representative Jim Cantwell. Before we move on to Kevin real quick here, you want to take a moment just to kind of talk about the Marshfield Elks?
Yes.
Paying a little homage to Dad, who was one of the founding members, charter member of the Marshfield Elks?
Yeah, we just had this weekend, we had 8 new members of the Elks who were initiated. I was one of the 8. But the coolest thing of that is, and I didn't know this was happening, is they had my dad come. My father was one of the charter members of the Marshfield Elks. When we talk of organizations that do so much to help people in Marshfield. In fact, they just did a major turkey program where they were making sure that there were hundreds of families on the South Shore.
Giveaway,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But my dad started the Marshfield Elks with others like John White, charter members, back in 1972. So he was there to pin me with the pin to be an elk. And I was able to give him a pin for his lifetime of service. So it was a really cool
special moment. Right. So you're going to come back next week?
I'll be happy to.
6:20.
Sounds good.
And we're going to turn our attention to Kevin. Kevin is running for state representative.
Yes, thank you.
In the 7th Plymouth District. Just pull that a little bit closer so the boys and girls at home can hear you. Kevin is a Democrat who is seeking the party's nod next September. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Kevin.
So, again, my name is Kevin Higgins, and I'm a Democratic candidate for state representative in Abington, East Bridgewater, and Whitman. I grew up in Whitman. I graduated from Whitman-Hanson Regional High School. I then went on to graduate from the College of Public and Community Service at UMass Boston, and I'm currently concluding my graduate degree in public administration at Roger Williams University.
So, why run? Why be a politician? Why run for office?
Well, I think I'm currently a social worker with Old Colony Elder Services, and I've met a lot of people from the district who have just felt like public policy is not meeting their very basic needs. And in my experience, I just feel like we can do a better job, and I'm really excited.
Have you held a political office, for whether for a municipality or something on the state level, been appointed, or do you do something civically, maybe for the Elks or for the Lions or something like that?
Well, I was elected to represent my bargaining unit with SEIU Local 509, and I was also appointed to a regional ethics committee with Old Colony Elder Services.
How does that help you as to be a legislator on the state level?
Well, I think it just gives me a well-rounded perspective, especially when we talk about the potential consequences of legislation. I have the ability to sort of determine pros and cons.
Okay. What's the word since you've announced your candidacy? I'm sure you've been out there meeting and greeting people. What are people saying to you?
I have. So we've started my campaign raising signatures for Raise Up Massachusetts ballot initiatives. And we've had a really overwhelmingly positive response. And I think, you know, people are really excited to talk about the issues. And they're also excited to see a younger person in the race.
When you talk Raise Up, if for folks who don't know what that group is, what the organization is, what it is they do, to kind of give a little background on that.
Sure. Raise Up Massachusetts is an advocacy group, and they propose 3 ballot measures this year. One is for the Fair Share Amendment, another is for paid family and medical leave, and also to raise the minimum wage.
Okay. And what's been the support for that? Are you getting a good feedback from folks?
So far, it's been really positive. I think people are really excited about paid family and medical leave because we really shouldn't have anyone who has to choose between their employment or taking care of a sick loved one. So I think we've definitely had a good response so far.
How about as far as the minimum wage increase? Mm-hmm. We know that Massachusetts incrementally is going to be doing it. Is it this year, the last year that it's going to bump up? That'll bump up to, I think, like $11 an hour, but what's the ceiling? Is it going shooting for 15? And do you feel that that's something that's going to hurt businesses?
I don't think it's going to hurt businesses if we look at a way for tax relief and financial relief for small businesses. I think equitable wages is a way to stimulate the economy, and people do understand that. I think sometimes voters hear 15 and they think it might be a little bit too high. But we also still, you know, this very basic notion that anyone who works 40 hours a week should not live in poverty. And I think that's a message that's been demonstrated clearly and has been received well.
Jim, you're kind of just sitting here. You're a legislator. Anything that you'd want to ask a prospective candidate who might end up being a colleague of yours next November,
Yeah, I think one of the most important, it's a credit to you, Kevin, we just met for the first time, is saying it's good to have young people, you know, putting forward ideas and getting involved, and I congratulate you because it's a very challenging time. What's a message that you bring to young people right now who, you heard me talking before about all the things, that positive things that get accomplished, bipartisan fashion, but I think for your generation, folks are so cynical about what government can do. So what kind of message do you have if people say, why are you running? We don't think you can make a difference.
I think right now it's really important to start to dispel this notion of political polarization and to really come together. I think I'm really hoping that my campaign could demonstrate a sense of unity and sort of bring more people together with bipartisan efforts and with, you know, bringing conservatives, liberals, Democrats, and Republicans together.
What's your understanding of the issues? Again, you're serving 3 communities within that district, and I'm sure that the issues of Whitman may not be the same issues of Abington or East Bridgewater and vice versa for those other communities. What are the issues that you understand them, whether it's within your district or on the state level.
Mm-hmm. So I think the three communities do have similar issues, especially when we talk about the opioid epidemic. We talk about education, investing in public education, and then also affordable health care. I think affordable health care is a big one that resonates in all three districts. All three towns. And I think we need to move towards more affordable healthcare. And I support single payer. And I think that it's also something that's been building momentum in all the three towns over the last couple of weeks.
But with that, with right now, you know, the ACA is something that's on the federal level. It's, there's not really much of a control other than to provide a mechanism or a vehicle like the healthcare,
right.
Healthcare. What would you be able to do, or what would you want to lead the charge on?
Well, I think it's about building coalitions. We saw Representative Denise Garlick's single-payer healthcare bill, which I think was a good start. And I think once we can build these coalitions, a bill like that could gain momentum.
Okay. What other issues other than the opioid? Because that seems to be a key one, and that's one that a lot of people jump on. What other issues that you're aware of that you want to tackle and you want to discuss with the voters in that district?
Well, the opioid epidemic is definitely one that I think we can make significant net gains on if we start to look at this issue as a multidimensional issue. And we talked about this last week, too. I think we really need to start integrating models of treatment that are, like I said, multifaceted. We need to think about sustainable housing. We need to think about this person's access to workforce attainment and education and healthcare. And I think once we do that, we're going to see net gains in this area.
One of the questions, whenever we do a political forum here, one of the questions usually that Christine James, our managing editor, will ask is, what are you going to do to bring home the bacon to your district? That's usually local aid. That's whether it's money for roads, whether it's money for education, and knowing that you are part, one of your communities has a split district. That's the Whitman-Hanson district. What would your methods be to try to bring home more money for projects and for local aid?
Well, I think one of the things we're going to be forced to look at is Chapter 70 funding and the way it's distributed. We're definitely going to have to look at the differences between a typical school district and a regional one, and we may have to look into revitalizing Chapter 70 funding so that districts like Whitman-Hanson can offer early childhood education like East Bridgewater's been able to do.
Okay. You got a last question?
Sure. One thing, because I didn't know by the districts, I'm aware of your Democratic opponent, Alex Bezanson, and you mentioned you made a great line before about unity. One thing I always ask folks is, one, make sure your race is all about you. You never want things to be, you don't want any negativity, but would you make sure to support your other Democrat? If you came a little bit short, would you be supporting Alex Bezanson and they'll ask the same thing of him?
I would anticipate that I'll support Alex Bezanson, but it will be all about the issues. So I think that when I hear more about public positions that he's taken, and if they resonate with my ideas, then I absolutely will.
And let's not close the door just yet as well, because this is an open seat,
right.
And usually with an open seat,
there are more. Yeah. and actually, I wrote that down. I had initially when my predecessor had been there for 26 years, and when he announced he wasn't running, there were about 11 candidates who were coming out. We ended up with four, and we all, one of the things we all did the pledge saying we weren't going to be attacking one another. Frankly, when people, Ed Perry says this all the time, locally, when people get to know other folks, they typically punish people if they get super negative. So I think you just talking here, it was very impressive to hear about your ideas. And I said, you do those, the other gentlemen do those, but we'd love to see everyone come together, because I know Alex Bezanson as well. I don't know the other gentleman you mentioned.
Peter Drosos.
Yeah, I don't know him.
Republican.
Okay.
Well, probably why you don't know him.
That's probably why.
Yeah.
He's a young guy, too. He's new to politics, just like Kevin is. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good.
And I'm definitely excited to have working relationships with these people for a long time, regardless of election outcomes. And that's what I said, a sense of unity, sense of togetherness, I think, can be restored. We can lead by example. We don't have to follow what's been seen on news in the last couple weeks and things like that.
We're going to wrap things up here. But, Kevin, it's been great having you on here. I'm sure
Thank you so much. You'll
be back, as will the other candidates. Folks want to find out more about you, how can they do that?
So our website is www.electkevinhiggins.com, and our Facebook page is Kevin for Seven. And I always give my personal cell phone number out. Please call me. It's 617-416-8657. Thank you for having me.
All right, you got it. We are going to step aside, and when we come back, the second hour of Monday Night Talk, trust me, you don't want to go anywhere. You're listening to 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This
is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, and I don't know if you know it, folks, but it is National Diabetes Awareness Month, and this is interesting because we got a great guest we're going to talk about in just a moment, but whether you know it or not, nearly 30 million Americans live with diabetes, more, making it the seventh leading cause of death in the United States. Now, according to the CDC, the number of adults diagnosed with diabetes has more than tripled in the last 20 years, nearly 40,000 Americans being diagnosed annually. Now, 5% of those patients are type 1 diabetes, which, unlike type 2, is not tied to a diet or a lifestyle and doesn't have a cure. Now, this is, again, in time for a National Diabetes Awareness Month. Dexcom, this is a company that develops, manufactures, and distributes continuous glucose monitoring systems for diabetes. It is actually celebrating its Call of the Warrior National Awareness Campaign. You actually can check that out, hashtag WarriorUp, that tells the personal stories of celebrities and everyday people taking control of their diabetes while living life to its fullest. Now, one of the participants who are part of this is actually a gentleman who is a world-renowned Olympic cross-country skier who actually lives here in the region, and we are joined on the phone line by Olympian Chris Freeman. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Chris.
Good evening. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about yourself as an athlete and also being somebody who has to endure a challenge like this when it comes to type 1 diabetes.
Well, type 1 diabetes is a disease that's with you all the time, and that's why having a continuous glucose monitor makes such a huge difference. The Dexcom system gives me a blood sugar reading every 5 minutes, 24 hours a day. And I've been using this tool since 2010, and it has really changed the way I can manage my diabetes, and it's allowed me to, you know, pursue the Olympics, pursue my sport at the highest level. And it's one of many innovations in diabetes care that has really changed the way that diabetes needs to be treated, needs to be looked at. This is not a debilitating disease anymore. It is a very, very treatable, very manageable disease as long as you take advantage of the innovations that are out there to help you.
Have you ever been told at some point that you would not to be able to compete at the level that you are to be able to compete in the Olympics?
Yes. Actually, at my time of diagnosis, I was diagnosed when I was 19 years old. So I'm 37 now, so wow. 18 years ago. 19 is actually a little old to be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, but it does happen. And I was told by the first doctor that no one had ever competed in the Olympics in an endurance event before, and that he didn't think it could be done. I went and sought a second opinion, and the second doctor was not nearly as nice as the first and actually laughed at me when I told him what my aspirations were.
Oh, my.
But I was able to, you know, to find a doctor who did believe in me, and I liked him because, you know, he was cautious. He knew that, you know, that there is, this is a very serious disease, but a manageable one. We had to take the necessary precautions, and we tried different levels of insulin with all the many different types of training that I do. But we found a way, and I believe that anyone with diabetes can find a way to go after their dreams and their aspirations despite their condition.
And it's worth noting that you are actually in the middle of training for your fourth Olympic Games, correct?
I'm actually in my training for my fifth Olympics. I've been in four now, starting back in 2002 all the way up through the last Olympics in Sochi in 2014.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's been a journey, and I have been traveling around the country speaking at Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation expos, telling my story, because there is a lot of misinformation, misconceptions about what having diabetes means to what you think you can do. And clearly, what I first heard when I was diagnosed was very negative. I proved those connotations wrong, and by embracing innovations like Dexcom's CGM, other insulin pumps, I really believe that you can do whatever you want with this disease.
And if you would be kind enough to kind of let folks know, how is type 1 diabetes different from type 2? And what should folks know about the treatment or prevention?
Well, type 1 diabetes, there really is no prevention. It's an autoimmune disease where the body actually attacks the islet cells on the pancreas, which basically means that my immune system killed off my insulin-making potential. I am completely dependent on artificial insulin delivered by a pump now. Whereas type 2 diabetes, the body still makes insulin. It's just that the body builds up a resistance to it. Sometimes that's due to lifestyle. Sometimes it's due to diet. Whereas in type 1, it is a straight-up autoimmune disease that people have not been able to determine the actual cause of. Just like thyroid disease, many, many people in this country suffer from thyroid disease, and it's the same principle. The body attacks the thyroid, and therefore you have to medicate from there on.
And I think you had mentioned in regards to glucose management, what is your understanding as far as innovations in helping manage your glucose or anybody who's looking to learn about managing their glucose?
Well, I would look into all of the options out there. But I find that the Dexcom continuous monitor has been a life-changing monitor, a life-changing device for me, in that it gives me a reading every 5 minutes. There are amazing software and share programs where, when I'm out training and running, my wife can actually view my blood sugar profile while I'm out there on her phone. So it's pretty remarkable. There are many different choices of insulin pumps out there now that you can tailor to what it is you want to do throughout the day, different programs. Unfortunately, at this point, everything when it comes to delivering insulin is still manual. So I am thinking constantly about how much insulin to take for all of my different meals, to maintain my glucose levels through workouts. But the Dexcom allows me to look frequently at my blood sugar levels very confidently and make the best decisions.
What was the process for you to become a partner with Dexcom when it comes to teaming up with them about National Diabetes Awareness Month?
Well, I think Dexcom is running a great program. It's the Call of the Warrior campaign. Yep. For National Diabetes Awareness Month. And what that is a warrior call is a photo or a video that's posted to Facebook or Instagram with the hashtag WarriorUp. And every time that happens, Dexcom will donate $1 to a diabetes charity. Those charities might work towards a cure for type 1, further research. It's a really a great campaign, and I highly recommend it. It's once again hashtag Warrior Up.
Okay, and where can listeners go for more information? Is there a website? Is there Facebook? Is it Twitter? What's some of the ways that folks can get involved?
Well, you can check out my Facebook page. It's just Chris Freeman, KRISFREEMAN, and I've got my Call of the Warrior up there right now. It's how I feel about diabetes, and you can get further information there.
How are you rounding into form for your fifth Olympics?
You know, I feel really good. I'm 37 now, so this will be my last go for the Olympics, but You know, no one from the U.S. has ever competed in 5 Olympic Games in cross-country skiing before, so I'm hoping to be the first.
Well, we wish you good luck. Hope you do well for your 5th Olympics. Anything you want to say in closing, my friend?
Anyone out there with diabetes or know someone with diabetes, please tell them to get educated about the amazing innovations that are out there, because it is so much, as hard as this disease is, it is so much easier to live with it when you really embrace the medical breakthroughs like Dexcom that have come through in the last decade.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us and informing our listening audience, especially in regards to the National Diabetes Awareness Month.
Well, thank you.
We segue away from talking to Chris Freeman, of course, an Olympic cross-country skier, to talking to an author. We're now joined by a best-selling, award-winning New England author. This gentleman's name is Archer Mayer, and he has just released his 28th installment of a very popular detective series called Joe Gunther. Mr. Mayer, welcome to Monday Night Talk, and I'm looking forward to talking a little bit with you about your series as I'm learning about this. How are you?
I'm very well, Kevin. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
I think what's very interesting here is and maybe to add a little depth to this, because we do have on a regular basis, we have authors on, and a lot of folks who, you know, they whether it's something that they write, that we had Maureen Boyle on not too long ago, and she was a former newspaper reporter who was covering, you know, a bunch of serial murders, and she was able to write a book about it. And that was fascinating because she was a reporter and somebody who was covering this. You, my friend, are somebody who is a modern day Renaissance man who is. Let me see if I can make sure I can identify all of your hats, and then you can correct me here.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. I was warned about this. you're a death investigator for the Vermont's office of the Chief Medical Examiner's Office, right?
Yep.
You are also a detective for the Windham County Sheriff's Office, right?
Yep, recently retired, but yes.
Okay, and then when you're not doing that, you're running into buildings and saving people because you are a volunteer firefighter EMT.
Correct. I also retired from that because I'm not getting any younger, but you're absolutely right on all counts. At some points, I was doing everything simultaneously.
and then, as though we weren't done with that, you're also somebody who has, now, I don't know if you're retired from this, but somebody who writes articles for AAA. You travel the country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I write articles. In fact, it's funny you should mention that. I no longer write for AAA, but I was just commissioned by, of all things, given my health habits, which do not include the obvious when I mentioned the periodical, which is Cigar Aficionado. And they hired me to write a piece about riding motorcycles, which I love to do.
And you also, give talks or do workshops on writing?
Yep, and forensics.
Wow. My goodness, when do you have time to relax?
I don't. This is all relaxing to me. There's nothing I like better than the company of a good dead body, and then writing about them in fictional form subsequently. I guess I'm sort of prone to being a bit of an action nut. I don't vacation. I don't weekend. I like working basically every moment I'm awake. That to me is relaxation.
That's interesting because you and I are alike. I swear that. Myself, I just got back from Paris, and I like to brag a little bit about it because it was my first. It was my first trip. But once I got back, I was actually back because I do, other than doing radio, whether I'm a radio reporter or being a talk show host, as I'm wearing that hat right now, I do TV production. And when I got back, we did a Comic-Con down in the Rhode Island area. So it's like I feel like I'm always on the go. Do you feel that way?
Oh, yeah, very pleasantly so. I have to admit that I'm probably, on any given weekend, if I happen to be forced to sit on a beach, I'll be the single most nervous guy on the beach because I got nothing to do.
Okay. So your latest installment of the Joe Gunther detective series is called Trace. And now this is actually set here in Massachusetts and also, well, actually regionally, because it takes place in Springfield, Vermont, and New York, right?
It takes place in Albany, New York, and Springfield, Massachusetts, as well as parts of Vermont. You're quite correct.
Okay. How did you come up with the concept of Joe Gunther? Do you take little bits and pieces of what you have lived? And
well, here's the weird part, Kevin, is that, in effect, as usual, given my general approach to life, I did it upside down and backwards. I began to write police procedurals, detective books, Vermont-based ones, long before I entered law enforcement. And what happened is because I am also trained in journalism and history, I used to write history books before, I do a lot of research. I believe quite strongly that even though I write fiction, I should tell the truth as I find it and elucidate my readers accordingly. So I was spending a lot of time digging around in police agencies and making friends with the guys and gals there and looking at the cases with them and whatnot. And eventually about 8 to 10 books into the series, one of them turns to me and says, "For God's sake, man, why don't you just join us? You know probably as much or more about what we do than we do." It seems like a wasted talent. And I burst out laughing and said, "Well, my God, this is a dream come true. Of course I'll add that job on to all the others I'm doing." Because at that point I was already a death investigator for the state. So I joined the Bellows Falls Police Department and never looked back. So for about 15 years I worked in the ranks of most of my time being spent on major cases, investigative work, plainclothes work, mostly sex crimes against kids.
Well, so my question to you would be, could you give us the premise for your latest title, Trace?
Well, actually, it's funny. The segue is perfect because if you look at TV or read the kind of books that I write, admittedly, you find you have one crime, you have one cop at least, and sometimes an entire squad all focused on this one crime. And it's, you know, the readers or the viewers can follow it along very easily, and it's all very intense and all very dramatic, and everybody's all very concerned about catching this one bad guy. And it makes for entertainment. But in reality, at any given time, I had anywhere on a good day, I had 15, on a bad day, I have 25 cases simultaneously going on in my head and needing to be addressed. And every cop I know handled the same workload. It was just part of the job. So I started to think that really what I ought to do for the first time in my writing career is introduce to my readers this type of reality. I wouldn't give, 20 cases to each one of my investigators, because in the book I follow about 4 of these guys. But at least give the readers an idea of the complexity of handling cases all at the same time. So in this book, Trace, I have 3 investigators, each one of which is pursuing a completely separate, unrelated investigation. And that's the story. So the challenge, obviously, is how do I write the book in a way where the readers don't get lost and don't get confused and don't think, oh, who's on first and what's on second? And from what I've been told by reviewers and by happy readers so far, I seem to have pulled it off. So I'm very happy with that, because I wanted to explain a little bit just how complex a real investigator's life can be.
So just kind of eyeballing your career, it seems as though since 1988, and I think there was maybe you had a little bit of a hiatus from your first book to your second book in 1990, it seems as though you're able to put out a book a year. How do you do that?
Yeah, at the very beginning, I stumbled around because I was segueing from the history books to the mystery books, and so one year I had 3 books come out at the same time. So it got a little lumpy, but fortunately, Kevin, I got to say, I drive a rusty secondhand pickup truck just like everybody in Vermont. Mm-hmm. I'm not rolling in dough, but I am one of the very few writers who actually makes a living writing. it doesn't hurt that I have all these other jobs, but that allows me all the time in the world, and we already discussed the fact that I don't know how to punch a time card. Last time I worked for a salary was 1978, and that's when I decided to hang out my own shingle and went independent. So the idea of writing at 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. makes no difference to me whatsoever. In fact, I was up most of last night on medical examiner calls. To me, it's a 24-hour day, and I find opportunities to do whatever I need to do, including sleep now and then. And it all fits rather easily together. I don't have a schedule, and therefore I'm not easily disrupted or thrown off track.
Again, we're speaking with New England author Archer Mayer, talking a little bit about the man, the myth, and his latest the latest book called Trace. Now, myself, admittedly, as a kid, loved series like Nancy Drew and yep. the Hardy Boys, and we yep. know that Hollywood somehow intervened and was able to put out a TV series. Any, do you aspire at all to see any of the things that you've written to somehow be put either on video, whether it be on TV or made into a movie?
Oh, I'd sell my soul in a New York minute, you betcha.
Really?
Oh, sure. Look, you know, the funny thing is everyone says, oh, don't do that because it won't be anything like the books. Well, I would hope not. I mean, these guys are artistically inclined, the better of them, and I would like to think that they would take the raw material that I supply them, which is what I do, and that they would then do what they do, which is to create, I hope, a somewhat different vision. I mean, these books come out of one's head, and they come out as they do for any number of complicated reasons. A book that I write on Monday could be entirely different than a book that I began on Tuesday. Very subjective stuff. So I make my choices, and I'm very happy with the end result. But if a movie maker or a TV show maker took a look at my raw material and said, hey, you know, I like these books, but I'd see it in a slightly different light, and I'd like to do this, and I'd like to do that.
Yep.
I'm delighted that they feel so empowered, you know, and I give them my blessing. Obviously, you hope the end result is a good one. That goes without saying.
Right.
But it might be fun if they came up with a new vision.
Well, here's the thing, though. I'm surprised. So you haven't been approached yet because you have.
Yeah, I have been. I have been.
Oh, okay.
I
but have been. But so yeah. Have you kind of picked it? So have you been kind of selective as to, is that why it hasn't happened yet? Because it hasn't been something that fits what you want to do or what your vision is?
It's a very weird world, as you can well imagine, Kevin. I mean, we hear about Hollywood all the time,
yep.
usually in very bizarre ways and sometimes not very appealing ones.
Yep.
And that's all true for me, too. I've had, over my very long career, 10, 12 movie options. I say movie. It could be TV. It could be movie.
Okay.
And they've all gone up. I'm under contract right now, and my fingers are very firmly crossed because I think for once I may be cooperating with someone who's got fire in the belly and a good creative imagination, and maybe we're off to the races. But in the past, there's been any number of bizarre things. Let me tell you one particularly amusing one.
Please.
Well, amusing now and rest. Go ahead.
No, please, continue.
Oh, okay. and so this guy calls me up after we had gone back and forth. He's very excited. He was a producer in Hollywood, and he thought he had a deal and the whole thing. And the punchline is he calls me up. He's in tears, literally crying on the phone. A Hollywood moment, dare I say. So I said, what's up? And he went, well, we were literally in the head guy's office, and there are eight of us that are all supposed to sign this contract, because it does take a crowd to turn out a movie, as we know from the end credits.
Sure.
So this guy, he's happy. He signed, and the other guy signed, and, you know, the fifth guy crosses the threshold and walks in, and he sees one of the early arrivals. and he stops dead in his tracks, and he says something rude, and turns on his heel, and just before he leaves, he says, "You screwed me over on that deal 5 years ago. Well, this is payback." And he walks out the door. So the deal fell through. It had nothing to do with my project. He was good with that until he saw this other cooperative guy, and that was the end of it. So this is a reflection of the arcane, multi-leveled, backstabbing, weird sort of Medici family stuff that we're talking about. So when things go wrong, they can go wrong for any reason under the sun.
So we will. I will join you in crossing fingers because it would be nice to see this series featuring Joe Gunther. And please forgive me here, but if folks, I haven't asked probably one of the essential questions about Joe Gunther. What kind of a guy is Joe Gunther?
Joe Gunther is, if you were to use a nautical metaphor, he's the keel of the boat. He is a solid, dependable, trustworthy, dare I say, even-keeled guy. So he's the center of this unit of eccentric investigators, some of whom are quite lunatic. And we follow all of them, and there are about four of them in the core, and then there are wives and girlfriends and people tied in, and people that go out to the side, medical examiners, people like that, that populate the outer fringes. Mm-hmm. But this group of four, Joe Gunther and his three primary investigators, take us through this series of books. And at various times, I'll put one or the other in central stage and play the light on them more directly than on some of the others. And otherwise, like on Trace, then each one of them has the limelight for a little while. And it allows me to do what I really like to do best, which is not, funnily enough, to explain solving crimes and to write murder mysteries, but to describe why people do what they do. Funnily enough, I don't really write murder mysteries so much as I write stories about people in crisis and conflict resolution, but that sounds so academic and so boring, you don't want to go there.
No.
So I put a dead guy in a car chase, in all these books, but my point is to reflect the world I inhabit as a death investigator and used to as a sex crimes investigator, which is filled with heartbreaking stuff, and it needs to be brought to people's attention, but not in a dour, downbeat, oh, God, I don't want to read about this terrible stuff fashion. So I try to sort of slip under the tent flaps of my readers and tell them about this terrible world in a not terrible way.
Now, are your books, Can folks just go to your website, or are they available on Amazon?
They're available in both areas. Go to archermayer.com.
Yep.
Surprise, surprise. And that is certainly a good place to start. But the books are available in stores. They're available at Amazon. If you can't find the books, just by asking the person behind the counter if they don't have them on the shelf, then you probably are in trouble because they're pretty easy to find.
Yeah, and when you go to the website, you'll find this handsome devil who's right on the front page, right on the home page, but then you see all his books displayed, and there's actually a list of all the different books that he has written since 1993 consecutively. He started in 88, like you said. He was busy doing other projects at the same time, but it was from 93 on that it's been a book a year. And yep. You've got videos on here. It's a fantastic website.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I try to make it user-friendly. I go to websites a lot and find them utterly confusing and misdirecting, so I try to make this as clear as I could.
Again, we've been speaking to a gentleman who the New York Times actually declares the boss man of police procedurals. He's an award winner, best-selling author, Archer Mayer. We want to thank you very much for coming on, and maybe we can somehow make you a regular on the program when it comes to various things, when it comes to police work and such as some of the other things that you do for a living.
I'd love the opportunity, Kevin. It's a big world, and I spend a lot of time in it, and I'm happy to discuss the details.
Well, I want to thank you so much, and I want to make sure I thank Sandra for reaching out to me and saying, hey, Would you mind having Archer Mayer on for an interview to talk a little bit about his book, his new book?
Yeah, good folks, good folks.
His
Thanks,
new,
Kevin.
You got it, sir. His new book, Trace. Check out the website, archermayer.com. Look him up on Amazon. Get a book today. This is a guy who actually, he lives it, he breathes it. You've been a fantastic guest. I thank you for your time, sir.
I appreciate it, Kevin.
Right,
carry
on. You carry on. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, our final segment here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, our final segment of the evening. And what you were listening to is the Jubilate Choral of Southeastern Massachusetts. I think I said that right. I'll find out in just a half a second. But this is a special, a unique, a requested segment by a gentleman who is actually going to be my guest co-host, a gentleman who I work with in another medium, Mr. Paul Watson, and he's also a member of the Jubilate Choral.
Chorale.
I can start the whole segment over if you guys want.
No, that's okay. Just keep going.
Chorale would be the correct way to say that. You can hear them in the background.
Yes, they call it that because we horse around a lot.
If we could bring that up. Beautiful blend of voices. Of course, led, conducted by music director Maxine Aslan. Did I say that right, Maxine?
Yes,
Maxine
is
here. She is the co-host.
I'm the co-host.
Yes.
All right.
As is Jay Enos, who is the president of the Jubilate Chorale.
Correct.
Welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you.
It's
Thank
an
you.
Honor. It's a privilege to be able to chat with you and talk about the history. I know that a big milestone is coming up. 40 years. Is it 40 years?
It's 40 years.
40 yes. years. Yeah, we're also going to, we're actually going to promote towards the end of the segment an upcoming event coming up on December 10th, a Christmas program.
Yes.
So we'll talk a little bit about that. Paul, I want to thank you. Paul, I actually work with in television. It was one of those things where from time to time he listens to the program. He's a listener, he's an avid listener. And he says, you know, would you mind doing something on the chorale? And I said, sure. And I've had the opportunity, the privilege to meet Maxine in the past as they've done different things television-wise. And I said, this would be a fantastic opportunity because it's teamwork and to kind of be able to choreograph, to kind of get everybody on the same page, to pick music, timepieces. It's fantastic.
Thank you. We think so too.
Let's start with you, Maxine.
All right.
How long have you been a part? How long have you been part of the chorale? And how long have you been part of music?
Well, I don't know which one to answer first. I do think, although I lose track, that this is my 35th year conducting the chorale. I think that's correct, because they hired me in 1982. And my interest in music, that goes back to when I was 9 years old.
Wow.
And it's not changed at all. I can remember telling my mother, "Mom, I'm going to be a singer when I grow up." And she said, "Okay, honey. Okay."
And was this something that you did as part of, like, church choir? Was it choir? Or was it something that you wanted to be somebody? Do you have vocal training? Isn't it something that you do, that you've done as part of a career?
Yes, definitely. I received 2 degrees in voice performance, and at the time I was living in New York, and I auditioned for a lot of singing things, classical things mostly, and for many of them I was chosen. So I was able to earn a living in New York City doing this in addition to teaching swimming at the local Y.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, diversity, it's called, I do think.
Absolutely. Was it breaststroke or was it the butterfly?
Oh, I taught adults how to swim.
Period.
Yeah.
The art of buoyancy.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct.
Let's turn our attention over to Jay. Jay, how did you get involved? Again, being the president of the Jubilate Chorale, how did you get involved with the chorale and your background in regards to music? And again, we'll bounce back to Maxine because she has quite the storied career. But I also want to hear about you as well, Jay.
Yeah, well, music, I guess, dates back to when I was about 4, and they used to prop me up in front of the family and ask me to sing. And they thought it was really interesting. I sounded like Elvis at 4 years old. So it went on from there. But as far as the Jubilate Chorale is concerned, I was involved in a choir at a local church, and a lady from Brockton came in to direct us, named Marita Bizankowskis. And we became very good friends. And we saw one day that she was performing with the Jubilate Chorale at the Lutheran Church in Brockton. So we thought we'd go. And I went, and I was singing with another chorale, another group at the time. And I heard the Jubilate Chorale, and I said, I have to sing with that group. So I approached Maxine downstairs at the reception, and I called the appropriate number, the rest being history, except for the fact that Maxine was not directing the year that I started. So I actually auditioned for Dr. Steve Young, an extraordinary organist. So I've been with the chorale since 1998, so I'm looking at my 20th in their 40th, of which I think 9 years I've spent as president.
Okay. Paul, how did you become a member of the chorale?
Oh, it's a storied past. I was singing in a church choir in Braintree, and the director on that said, "Would you like to come and sing at a group with me?" And it wasn't Jubilate, it was a Ralph Farris chorale in Dover. But then I got married and moved to the Brockton area, and that was just too long a trip to make. And I was hunting for a group to sing with down there, and I just happened to stumble across the concert in a listing in the paper. And when I went, I said, I'd like to sing with this group. And that started me. I came in a little bit before Jay, but I took a little bit of time and sang with another group for a few years because I couldn't handle more than one at a time anyway. I mean, I'm lucky I can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Okay. So. How did the Jubilate Chorale get started? Does it have a storied past? How was it organized and formed?
It was organized well over 40 years ago, but at the time, I think one of the names was the Brockton Choral Society, and I don't think that was incorporated, but I'm not sure. And then they went for another name, Musica Viva. And they discovered that that name was already incorporated. And so a friend of ours, in fact, he used to sing with chorale, but he also plays in the orchestra. His wife sings with us, and they were talking amongst themselves, and they came up with the name Jubilate, which means be joyful. Mm-hmm. And that's how it, they wanted to incorporate, they wanted to become nonprofit, they wanted to be able to go after funds and offer the people who gave financially, you know, a relief on taxes and all of that. Plus, you are then eligible to go for, to apply for grants. And most grantors look for organizations that are tax exempt. So that is the way we came about.
What are some of the successes that the chorale has seen over the years? What are some of the things, some of the performances, maybe some of the travels?
Oh, goodness. Up until recently, we always traveled about every 3 years. Our first trip, I think, was in my third year with them when we went to the former Yugoslavia and Italy. And we traveled with a local orchestra. There were about 110 singers and about 50 people in the orchestra, and this caravan went around Yugoslavia, and every place we went, the halls were absolutely crowded. Okay, that's one thing. And then on another trip, we were invited by the Danish government to come and do take part in a festival. They were having a choral festival. So we went there and had a great time. I took a smaller group to Austria, Germany, Switzerland. We've gone to Canada. We have been invited by music travel agencies to go to some of their, what do you call them?
Festivals.
Thank you. We have sung at the Christmas celebrations at the Breakers Mansion in Newport. And I think the one that was really so much fun, I have a chamber ensemble which is taken out of Jubilati Chorale. And we went to sing at the Opera House for the performances of the Nutcracker Suite. So we were situated right in the very, like when you're coming in, you're going up the stairs, we were situated in a little place by the stairs, and we started singing. Well, the audience members that were coming in stopped moving. So the ushers had to ushered them, quicken them into the auditorium. We had a great time.
There was a story in Maxine I'd like you to tell, too, about the piano in Venice.
Oh, God, that was our trip to, first trip to Yugoslavia. So we were in Venice, and I knew we were going to be singing at this huge church, and it was just beautiful. And there was, we went inside, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, I don't see the piano anyplace. Maybe So we were sitting out in the outdoor little restaurant that was nearby, and we were talking about this, the piano, and I'm looking up the chorale. Oh my word, here comes a large gondola handled by one gondolier, having in the front of this an upright piano. I'm thinking, I think there were more pictures taken of that. The piano arrived via gondola. It was wonderful.
It was a rental? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I had visions of it going into the canal.
What are some of the challenges? You know, you're talking about traveling and going to different venues. Being the person who's the music the conductor, I mean, do you not worry about other than every member arriving there, but the acoustics itself?
Yeah, not so much, because when they go on a tour, they are already prepared musically. The acoustics are within my responsibility. So I know if it's very, very live, the pieces that go fast have to be slowed down, or otherwise you have an echo effect going around, and auditoriums that are very, very dead, we speed things up. So You know, I can tell as soon as I walk in and say a word how it's going to be, you know. And they understand this because they've been through all situations. But it was a joy to travel with them.
Jay, what have been some of your memorable experiences as part of the Jubilate Chorale over the years?
Well, I didn't make the Italy trip, but I certainly was in the Canada trip. And one of the things I remember, outside of singing at the Chateau Frontenac, which was extraordinary, we sang at a church called the American Erskine Church in Montreal. And in the American Erskine Church, American Erskine Unity Church, they had real Tiffany stained glass. And we walked in and we just all looked up and everybody just stopped and your mouth dropped open. You're looking at this stained glass and you see stained glass in churches everywhere, but you'd never see anything like this. And it's just extraordinary. So that sort of set the mood. And we began to sing. And one of the things that Max always... We call her Max. Sometimes we call her Mother.
Can I call you Max too?
Oh sure. Okay. Definitely.
Because I was going to call you Doctor too. So I know you do have.
No.
Sometimes she's our doctor.
Oh.
But anyway, we were singing a particular piece, and Max always tells us that we sing too loud, which we probably do, and she wants us to sing soft and sweet and harmonious. And there was one spot where we would just hit it just right, and I could see it in her face. And we knew we had hit it just right. And that just stays in my mind, in my memory. Other than that, I remember that we did a festival trip in Vermont. And Max had actually considered retiring. And we were all in a huff, and we were all scrambling, and what are we going to do? We started a program to find a director, and we were having no luck. And we had such a wonderful trip. And we did an extraordinary job, and everyone recognized what we did, including the other groups that participated in the festival. And on the way back, Max decided that she would stay. And she's been with us ever since. But the extraordinary thing is coming back on the bus, coming down through the countryside, and we took some back roads, not the highway, and we looked up, and there's this huge hot air balloon with a big happy face. So we thought, that's an omen. That's it. We're all set. We got our Max back. So it's been quite a ride for us. Quite a ride.
What's the process like to put together a show? And is the show onto its own? What's that like for you? And are there pieces that are a must for every performance that you're putting together, Max?
Oh, mercy me. You've hit upon probably the hardest job for a conductor, choosing a program. Sometimes I have an idea in my head like, okay, I want to do a program on poets, well-named poets who have had their poetry set to music. Okay, so that starts me looking. I have bookcases filled with samples of music, so I start looking there. The problem is I can find all the music, but I can't find a title a lot of the times. So the people that I associate with on the board always come up with a title. And the program we're doing on December 10th has had it in the back of my head that this was going to be audience related and reflecting our 40th anniversary. And how could we come up with a title that might show this? And then one of the members came up with a title called Christmas Together.
So, sounds nice.
Yeah.
I like it.
There is a little piece of information that kind of goes along with this thing.
Well, please share.
It's where it's the 40th anniversary, we have a lot of past members coming back to sing, and we'll be performing two pieces from the Messiah at the end of the concert that they will come up and join with us. So we won't be 60 voices, we'll be closer to 100 at that point.
Wow.
I thought it was appropriate that we're, since we have reached this milestone, that we would ask former singers to come and sing with us. Well, they have come out of the woodwork. One's coming down from New Hampshire. They're coming from Rhode Island. They're coming from Worcester. There are a total of 21 alumni, we call them, alumni singers coming to perform with us.
How does that make you guys feel? That you know, that alumni, folks who were once a part of the chorale, are still willing to flock down, no matter where they are now spread out?
Makes me feel fantastic.
Yeah. It's like a family, Kevin. we wouldn't, those of us who have been in the corral for a long time, can't think of anybody else running that show there but Maxine, because she has become that much of a mother figure to us as far as music goes.
Matriarch, right.
And, you know, we call her all kinds of things. We call her... We call her a instead of a conductor, a condictator. She's it's basically it's a benevolent
dictatorship.
Dictatorship in there.
Definitely.
And I would pay sometimes, I'm sure, to just come in and watch her rehearse the group, because she puts on quite a show for us during rehearsals.
Oh, absolutely. She's an excellent dancer, by the way.
Really?
Oh, yes. Demonstrative.
And it helps a lot, you know, when she's trying to get something out of you, if she gets up there and has some kind of an antic, because she shows you physically what she wants the music to feel like.
Oh, how absurdly you're doing it.
We've been very absurd over the years.
By the way, as far as the togetherness with our former members are concerned, for those who are on Facebook, like my mother is, my mother... See that you did that to me, my dear wife. There, all our former members are on Facebook, and so they all feel like it is my jubilate. They still refer to it as that.
And you actually do have a website. Actually, one of the pieces that we came into,
yes,
was off of the website.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes,
which was.
Damon?
No, it was Sinnerman.
Sinnerman. Oh, right.
Right. We were discussing that, so that's why why it was fresh on Max's mind.
Sinnerman, correct.
And just so folks know, I can't believe we've already burned through two-thirds of our conversation here, but we have Maxine Esslin, who is the conductor and music director. She also has the DR at the front of her name, but she doesn't want me to call her Dr. Max. But we have Jay Enos, the president of Jubilate Chorale, and member and guest co-host of the show, this segment of the show, Paul Watson, here kind of talking a little bit about the Jubilate and the family and how it works. How many shows a year would you say does the Jubilate put together or put on?
We do two major concerts, one in December, one in May. And we have gone other places, like we've gone into Boston to go to, guys, help me with the
Tremont
name.
Temple.
Yeah, Tremont Temple.
On during February, which is Black History Month.
Yes,
they do a big gospel choir celebration.
Yeah.
And we are not a gospel choir, but we have gone in there and sung gospel music. And you need to tell the people
what
you heard back from the other choir directors after our first appearance there.
Okay, we were fortunate, and I was scared to death. I really was very nervous because I know that the choir from Tremont had sung at the funeral for Senator Kennedy. And I thought, oh my, they're really, really good. So we got there, and everybody was so friendly and so loving. And there were a sea of all different color faces, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. When we sang this O Sinner Man, which you started the program with, and then we sang another one, which was sort of gospel, but not really. And the director, the music director from Tremont, came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, I looked at what you were going to sing, and I thought, oh, boy. You know, here comes a choir not experienced in this type of singing. And he said, you know, you sing just like a Southern gospel choir. And I said, thank you very much.
That is very interesting that someone
was
equated to that. How much practice goes into a performance? I mean, how many hours a week are you rallying, getting these guys all rounded into form to sound like the performance that you want to hear, that you hear in your head as a director?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have an easier job because so many have sung with me. Mm. So they're used to what I'm after. So, and they read very well. So putting a new piece of music in front of them is a little challenging, but they rise to it. We rehearse 2.5 hours a week, but part of that time is given over to our break time so we can socialize with each other, which is necessary.
It's like herding cats trying to get them back into the rehearsal again, too. I know, because I'm one of them.
Are you one of those?
Oh, I'm one of those, yes.
Especially when there's homemade cookies available.
Yeah. We have a chef in our group who brings us homemade cookies every week. We don't call him by his name. We call him Cookie Man.
Oh, yes. He loves it, too, and we love the cookies.
Yeah.
But, you know, we talk about 2.5 hours a week, but that's just the frosting on the cake, really, for actual. That's rehearsal. Practice, there are those of us, especially in the bass section, who need to go over the music for hours a week. Bass can be
tricky,
less than melodious sometimes. So, yes,
yeah, all by itself,
a lot of hours put in. Yeah, well, one quick story. I remember rehearsing by myself late into the evening and doing these bass parts, which can be particularly ugly, especially when you're just trying to learn them. And my wife, who was trying to sleep, came walking into the kitchen, and she looked at me, she said, "Put everything away." And I just looked at her, "Okay, dear."
You have to do that sometimes, Jay.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Absolutely. We got a little less than 5 minutes left in the program, and I want to thank you guys for coming in and talking a little bit about the Jubilati Chorale of Southeastern Mass. Anything that I haven't asked or anything that we haven't touched upon, and I think I'm looking at you, Paul, just in case I've overlooked anything, other than to kind of once again promote the December 10th program, Christmas Together.
Well, that's one of the favorite concerts for a lot of people, because that particular concert every year involves some amount of audience participation.
Ooh.
during the times when we're moving around to get the major choir out and the smaller group in, they sing a Christmas carol along. You know, Maxine just gets up there and waves her hands and they sing, because you can't direct some people who don't know what they're doing, except they've got it in their head at one way and you never get it out. And the people love that. They've always loved singing those Christmas carols during that particular time.
There's one qualitative thing regarding the chorale that I could bring up. Many years ago, we commissioned James Mulholland to do a piece, and he came to see us and direct the piece at rehearsal. And he and the publisher said to us, "You, Jubilati Chorale, in our estimation, rank in the top 4 or 5% in the country."
Wow. Why is it called Jubilati?
We're so joyful.
I think that's just the word one of our former basses came up with, because they were looking to choose a name. In a way, it's unfortunate, because the pronunciation is usually wrong, and that brought that
jubilate.
We get jubilate, etc. But actually, it's a good name.
The man who came up with it happens to be on a cruise in the Mediterranean right now. We would have brought him.
Well, that's why we're talking about it behind his back.
Right.
And we should, and it's just so folks who are listening, as we're getting ready to wrap up this segment, where is the Christmas Together program going to be held? It's in Brockton, on Pleasant Street in Brockton, the
Christ Congregational Church, 1350 Pleasant Street in Brockton.
At 3 o'clock in the afternoon on December 10th.
And I think it bears asking, are you ever looking for new members, and is there a process for new members?
Oh, yes. The first couple rehearsals. There is a small committee that listens to them afterwards, you know, to see how their voice is, what section they should be put in, whether they have a good ear.
If they're pitchy and all of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Folks who are listening, and again, I know you're always looking for membership, so it wouldn't be a bad thing if somebody listening to this might want to join. Maybe they have a voice and they have a talent. Like, this might be and to be guided by Max. That's
thank you.
It's worth the price of admission.
Is it, Jay? Is it worth the price of admission?
You're welcome to come and try, too.
Before we go, can I say thank you very much for having us on? It means a great deal to be recognized. Thank you.
Well, I'm thinking the next time, and I say this as we're wrapping up this segment with the folks from the Jubilati Chorale of Southeastern Massachusetts. I think where you and I are in another medium, probably next time what we should do is have some cameras in here, and that could kind of complete the process.
So definitely.
Because especially like when Jay was talking about you, how you dance when you're dancing around. Unfortunately, radio is not a visual medium that people could see that. And there could be something that we could tell folks to go on to the YouTube.
You are missing so much.
Yes. Yes. So I think next time, and there will be a next time if I have anything to say about this. I want to thank all of you.
Thank
for being
you.
Here, especially Jay and Max for being a part of this. Paul,
thank you.
As well, being the voice of reason, saying, hey, we should do a segment on the Yubel Arte Chorale. And it's been an honor and a privilege, as I said at the beginning. And we look forward to checking out the December 10th show, Christmas Together. Congratulations on 40 years or your 40th anniversary and many more successful years ahead.
Thank you very much.
You got it. And you have been listening to Monday Night Talk, heard here on 959 WATD worldwide, 959WATD.com. And to you and yours, may you have a fantastic Thanksgiving holiday. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com, the South Shore's news, weather, and traffic station.